Welcome back to the program. The events that have been happening in the Congo are truly one of the world's great tragedies, yet we pay little attention to what's going on there. Millions of war deaths have taken place. Over 3.5 million refugees have fled the country. But even for those trying to understand what's going on, the complexity is stunning. Over 20 rebel groups are fighting. It involves the armies of 9 countries, and the objectives and the causes are even murkier. We're going to talk about this tragedy today with my guest, Jason Stearns. He's been working on the conflict in the Congo for the past 10 years. In 2008, he was named by the UN Secretary General to lead a special UN investigation into the violence in the country. He's also worked for a Congolese human rights group and for the United Nations peacekeeping operation. It is my pleasure to have Jason Stearns here to talk about his new work, Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, the Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. Jason Stearns, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. One of the things that is the most remarkable, I guess, as a place to start on this, is that we're talking about one of the largest places on the planet that literally has no functioning government.
Yes, I think it's important to remember that the Congo is in a desperate state now. But the reason it is in a desperate state, and the reason that many of its state institutions are dysfunctional or don't function, has a very concrete history. So rather than just seeing this as an abject mess and an incurable mess, what I try to do in the book is to trace the history that has led us to where we are today. And that history, of course, stretches back to Belgian colonization, to when the Congo was actually the private domain of the Belgian king, and even before that to slavery and the rubber trade that tore into and devastated the fabric of Congolese society. Because it's important to remember that back in the 17th, 16th century, the Congo was home to some of the strongest African kingdoms. And so this is not a case where Congolese are somehow incapable of creating strong institutions, but it's a historical legacy of the various waves of bad governance and colonization.
And, of course, for 30-plus years, there was a dictator that the United States had been supportive of.
Mobutu Sese Seko was indeed in power for 32 years. He was part of U.S. strategy, Cold War strategy in Africa. He was seen as a bulwark against communism in neighboring countries. And almost more than him being a puppet of the U.S., to a certain degree, the U.S. was a puppet of Mobutu. He was incredibly astute and agile in manipulating interests in Congress as well as in the White House, and he visited the U.S. on numerous occasions. He was a very close ally.
And, of course, the other aspect of the Congo that can't be overlooked is the degree to which it is so rich in natural resources.
They call it a geological scandal. There's just this panoply of different minerals and resources in the Congo. Famously, the uranium for the bomb that we dropped in Hiroshima came from the Congo. And even today, a lot of the minerals that feed the electronics industry, tin, tantalum, tungsten, come from the Congo and are actually linked to the ongoing conflicts in the Congo.
Talk about the ways in which those resources are linked today.
So it's important to realize that the war that started in 1996 and the conflict that's ongoing today was not started initially by natural resources. This is not, as I try to lay out very clearly in the book, this is not a case of greedy, barbaric African rebels raping and pillaging their land in order to get their hands on minerals. The war that started in 1996 was about regional politics and power, as so many wars are. And minerals didn't really come to play a major role in this until somewhat later in the war. So I think it's very important to remember that, because we should also recall that solving the minerals issue, creating more accountable supply chains and minerals, is not going to do away with conflict altogether. That's much more, that's much more a story about state reform that you need to think about. But the way that it's linked today in the Eastern Congo, you need to imagine the Eastern Congo is an area perhaps the size of Florida, where you have thousands of different mines. This is largely tin mines, but also tantalum mines that are distributed over a very wide area and that are mined artisanally. That means with people with picks and shovels. And most of these supply chains, most of these mines, as well as the trade routes leading out of the mines, are taxed by various different armed groups. It's more of an extortion racket, I think, than taxation racket. And it's through this extortion imposed by armed groups that the minerals trade leads to a large part of the financing of these armed groups and therefore also to the conflict in the Eastern Congo.
To what extent did the genocide in Rwanda play a role in the events that have evolved in the Congo?
It's a very complicated story. Certainly, I would say that this is how I begin the book, actually. It begins with the genocide in Rwanda. The genocide in Rwanda was probably the proximate cause of the war in the Congo. You had two main causes. You had the collapse of the Zairean, the Congolese state under Mobutu's misrule. And then the other side of the border, you had this, the genocide in Rwanda that killed 800,000 people, and it drove a further million people across the border into this vacuum of a state, into the Congo. And along with these refugees, these million refugees, came the people who had perpetrated the genocide. So the war in the Congo, the seeds to the war in the Congo really began in significant part with the Rwandan genocide, with the fleeing of the perpetrators of the genocide across the border, and then the new Rwandan government that came to power at that point thought obviously that it was inadmissible or it was an impossible situation to sustain to have their arch enemies lurking across the border in the Congo. So they invaded the Congo in 1996 to break up those refugee camps, and in the process they then went on to topple Mobutu, and they put then a new leader in power, Laurent Kabila, with whom they fell out later.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you write about that kind of resulted from this is that because there were so many different tribal groups, that there were kind of wars inside of wars inside of wars going on.
Yeah, this is a key feature of the Congolese conflict. The Congo, I think one of the most important things to understand about the Congo conflict is that the Congo is cursed with complexity. Why do I say cursed? It's cursed because, as opposed to other conflicts where you can identify a clear, or at least you can simplify the conflict to two sides, and in many cases we tend to missimplify to good guys and bad guys. The Congo, that's impossible. The Congo has seen dozens of different armed groups fighting their way across the country for a host of different reasons. And amongst these different armed groups, it's very difficult to identify any heroes, any people that we should back. And it's this complexity, this war within wars that you just described, that has made it impossible to encapsulate by journalists. I met many of my friends who are journalists who had just end up wringing their hands with despair describing the Congo, because on the one hand, the suffering is terrible. On the one hand, the level of suffering, 5.4 million people dead, it rings out incredibly clearly as this clarion call to action. We need to do something. On one hand, the statistics speak for themselves. On the other hand, when you take the next step and then try to say, well, what's at the root of this, it becomes very, very difficult and complex to describe. So whereas the suffering is as high as it is many other of the great cataclysms of the 20th century, the Cambodian genocide or the Rwandan genocide, the nature of the war, its complexity, has made it very difficult to describe. And I think, at least in my book, one of my main points is it's this complexity, this difficult narrative that's difficult to spin, that has made us ignore and care less about the conflict.
And to what extent is the conflict being driven today by Congo's neighbors?
So the conflict has shifted dramatically in recent years. It began in 1996 and continued with a new war breaking out in 1998. And up until 2003, it was really a regional war where you had, as you described in the introduction, nine different African countries involved with their militaries in the Congo. Now, that situation came to an end in 2003. All of those regional countries largely withdrew their troops. There was a peace deal signed with all the major rebel groups. They joined a peace process that led to elections in 2006. They were won by the then incumbent President Joseph Kabila, who remains president until today, and in fact there are elections coming up later this year. Now, unfortunately, those elections that took place in 2006, while bringing an end to the countrywide conflict, they led to an escalation of the conflict in the Eastern Congo. And part of the reason for that escalation was that one of the main rebel groups that had been one of the main factions, they had gone from controlling a third of the country. This is the RCD rebel group that was backed by Rwanda, had gone controlling a third of the country to controlling only about 3% of elected representatives in parliament and elected institutions. That then triggered, it was part of the triggering of a new rebellion in the Eastern Congo that then consumed the Eastern Congo between 2000 and, I would say, 2004 and basically this year, with different permutations and alliances coming through. Now, to come back to answer your question, Rwanda in particular did play a strong role in that rebellion, and Rwanda was also concerned about the remnants of the people who had perpetrated the genocide and opposition, Rwandan opposition groups, rebel groups based in the Congo. But there were also more economic incentives involved with Rwandan involvement. So Rwanda did play a very strong role up until very recently. Now, the dramatic shift that happened around 2 years ago now, when Rwanda and Congo, this has been this rift that has defined the whole conflict between Rwanda and the Congo, they made a peace deal for the first time, really, a sincere peace deal, or a moderately sincere peace deal that has calmed down the conflict a little bit in the Eastern Congo. Now, the main, I would describe, the regional influences have decreased a little bit, although they still remain very important. The main challenge now that most people dealing with the conflict in the Congo now face is the fact that the Congolese state itself is a predatory state. It's very ill-disciplined. And when we talk about the astronomic rates of sexual violence, for example, the many of those rapes are being carried out by the Congolese army itself. So it is a matter of trying to deal with these regional tensions, but it's also now more and more a matter of trying to reform Congolese institutions to make them serve their own people rather than prey on them.
What about other conflicts that are playing out on Congolese soil? For example, Rwanda and Uganda fought their own battles in the Congo.
Yeah, this is, the Congo, because it was sort of this failed state, really, for much of this period, became then sort of the carry-on upon which all of these scavengers from the region feasted on, unfortunately. And you had all of these regional armies involved in the Congo, initially because they were hunting down, or they said they were hunting down, rebel groups from their own territories. So a Ugandan rebel group established itself on Congolese territory and launched attacks on Uganda, which prompted Ugandan involvement. A Rwandan rebel group did the same, which prompted invasion by Rwanda. Angolan rebel groups did the same. I mean, it was really, especially by the end of Mobutu's regime in 1996, this was really a country that had become host to a dozen, roughly, foreign rebel groups, which then contributed to this continental war that took place. Now, unfortunately, to a certain extent, these neighboring countries got their hands caught in the stuck in the cookie jar. They went into the Congo and then realized that the Congo was not only full of rebel groups, but also full of many, many economic opportunities. This was then part of the reason that Uganda and Rwanda, that had been tight, tight allies initially, they then fought two separate wars over the large town of Kisangani, that's at the bend in the Congo River, in the process of which they pretty much destroyed the town, or they killed thousands of civilians. This was a war fought with heavy artillery, street-to-street combat. It was incredibly detrimental to civilians. And this, I think, was beginning of the time when the veil began to drop on these foreign occupiers, when people began to realize, wait a second, maybe Rwanda and Uganda aren't just in the Congo for self-defense, to protect their territories against these rebel groups they keep on talking about, but maybe there are other motives involved as well, including economic motives. But in the case of Uganda and Rwanda, in addition to those economic motives, just to add an additional layer of complexity, there was sort of this big brother, little brother syndrome, because the current Rwandan government, actually many of the people, including the current president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, were officials at some point in the Ugandan government. They had been brought up in Uganda, and they had fought in the Ugandan army, and then from Uganda they had launched a rebellion against Rwanda that had brought them to power in Rwanda. So there was this big brother, little brother syndrome. In the book I call it Cain and Abel syndrome, between Uganda and Rwanda that made that relationship, made that biting, the fight that broke out between them all the more bitter.
Rwanda and Kagame specifically still seem to see the vacuum that exists in the Congo as an economic opportunity.
Rwanda's involvement in the Congo is very complex, and it's very difficult to encapsulate it in a couple of sentences. But what is Rwanda's involvement in the Congo initially did begin as a security problem. As I said, the perpetrators of the genocide in Rwanda fled across the border, and the Rwandan civil war was basically continued to be carried out on Congolese soil. And so Rwanda invaded with this Congolese rebellion in 1996 and break up these refugee camps to attack the perpetrators of the genocide and other militia. So initially that whole period was, you could describe it as self-defense, but then came the economic interests. Rwanda is a very, very poor country. It's a largely agricultural country with a huge population and a lot of demographic pressures. The Rwandan government was fighting this war in the Congo that was very expensive. They had 30,000 soldiers deployed in the Congo, and they needed some way to finance it. So being in the Congo, they began to finance the war by being in the Congo itself. Even the President Kagame at one point said, this is a self-financing war, because they were financing it through the minerals and other resources that they accessed in the Congo. Excuse me. So that was an important part of, started to become a very important part of the conflict. And up until today, I would argue that that is very, very important for the Rwandan economy and even for part of their military involvement in the Congo up until today.
And, of course, there's been a conflict between the United States, which has been supportive of Kagame, and other Western European nations not so much.
Well, yes. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I describe in the book is this inability for us to see beyond a very simplistic notion of conflict in the Congo, and our tendency to have to try to find heroes and villains in this mess of a conflict. And one of the heroes that we initially identified was Paul Kagame. Here was a man who had come to power during the genocide, who is a member of the Tutsi community that was a victim of the genocide, who had displayed enormous vision in rebuilding his country. This was not somebody, a tin pot dictator from the mold of other African dictators that the U.S. had seen before. This was somebody with vision who was determined to drive his country forward. So I think that led a lot of officials in the Clinton administration that was in power at the time here to back Kagame. And they were unable to look beyond that, really, to see what he was doing in neighboring Congo. And in neighboring Congo, Rwandan troops that had initially engaged for, as I said, for self-defense, began being responsible of enormous mass abuses, first against the Rwandan refugee population that had fled there, and Kagame's soldiers were guilty of large-scale massacres against civilian refugees in 1996 and 1997, and then against the Congolese population when they were fighting a counterinsurgency war in the eastern Congo, and as so often, counterinsurgency wars turn very, very ugly, and the Rwandan government was responsible itself and through their proxy movements in the eastern Congo of massive abuses. And throughout this time, we pretty much looked the other way and tried to separate what was going on in Rwanda with what was going on in the Congo, when we really should have had a more coherent, nuanced policy towards the region.
You mentioned a kind of loose peace that has started to exist. Part of that has involved incorporating some of the most brutal of these warlords, though, into the ruling authorities.
It's a very biting dilemma for a government that's so institutionally weak. The Congolese government is so weak and has been so weak throughout the conflict that the option of just trying to suppress all of its rebel opponents, all of these warlords, is just not there. And because it's so weak, they end up in constant negotiation with armed groups, and they will go through this cycle where they negotiate with armed groups, even notorious killers and people who have been indicted by international tribunals. And because they can't beat them, they end up buying them off and co-opting them and giving them ranks in the army and giving them positions. And, of course, this is also, I think, encouraged by the fact that the government itself is composed of many people who have rather spotty human rights records. So we're in a bit of a vicious circle where they say, oh, they can't put their foot down against impunity and promote human rights because, we need to get a stable peace before we can do that, but you're never going to reach a stable peace because it then ends up that your whole army is composed of people who have bad human rights records and who continue these abuses. So they've been caught in this vicious cycle, and this is, I think, was at least during the peace process endorsed by many officials in the international community who saw justice as a bit of a nettle in their side. They wanted stability first and then justice afterwards, and constantly pushing for justice. Many diplomats even thought that that would destabilize the process. And yet here we are and ended up with a government full of people with bad human rights records.
And what, if anything, will these upcoming elections bring?
Well, this is a very important question. Elections are scheduled for November this year. This is going to be the second democratic election or multi-party democratic election in 40 years or 45 years now. And the first democratic multi-party elections that happened in 2006, these were the first elections after the peace process. These were extremely important. But to a certain extent, they were easier in the sense that the incumbent was favored to win. The incumbent at that point, the guy in power, Joseph Kabila, was favored to win. So and he won relatively free and fair elections back in 2006. This year, it's an entirely different dynamic altogether. And this year, Joseph Kabila, who's the current president, faces a much more difficult task in winning. He's become very unpopular throughout much of the country. He's failed to deliver, particularly on his promises of peace and stability in the East, but people are also dissatisfied with his record of governance and corruption. So he faces a much more difficult time getting reelected. So the danger this time is that we're going into an election where the incumbent is actually not favored to win a free and fair election. And therefore, the prospect of rigging and vote buying looms much larger, I think, than it did in 2006. Yet, the international community and donors who are helping finance this process, I don't think that's really clicked with them yet, and they're not really seeing the importance of these elections. Up until very recently, the U.S. government was not contributing at all financially to these elections, almost, other than some educational initiatives. And there are not nearly as many observers and nonprofit organizations working on promoting these elections as there were last time. So I'm quite frankly concerned.
And if the elections go badly?
If elections go badly, if the main challenge, as I described it, is reforming the Congolese state and making the Congolese state serve its own citizens more than prey on its own citizens, which is currently the case, then elections is the best chance we have in terms of creating more accountable institutions. It's not a silver bullet. They're going to be messy. The people who are put in power, even in free and fair elections, probably going to end up being being compromised, but it's still the best chance we have of pushing forward this democratic process. So I think that if it's not free and fair, we're going to get stuck with weak, bad institutions. This myth that the Congo needs an enlightened dictator to impose stability, I think that is exactly that. It's just a myth, and that's a dead end. So I think we do need to go forward with these elections. As bad as they may be, it's the only step forward towards greater accountability and giving the Congolese people the means they need to be able to hold their own leaders to account.
Jason Stearns, the book is Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa, just out from Public Affairs. Jason, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.